Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. All club members are cordially invited to take part in our forum. We have a monthly planning meeting the first Thursday of the month. The next one is April 1st, April Fool's Day at 5:30. Non-members in the audience are invited to join the Commonwealth Club. You'll find membership information and program information at the reception area and also on our website, commonwealthclub.org. I'll announce two upcoming International Relations Forum programs. On April 13, a Tuesday, we'll have a discussion of the 2048 Project, which is an ambitious plan for an enforceable is the key word here, Global Convention on Human Rights to be in place by 2048, the centennial of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights adopted by the UN in 1948. Our speaker will be J. Kirk Boyd, Executive Director of this project at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Then on June 2nd, a Wednesday, the topic is Myths and the U.S. Intelligence Community. Speaker Paul Clark, a former Air Force officer, served on the staff of the National Security Council at the White House and now teaches political science and international studies at Dominican University. Our usual reminder, please turn off your cell phones as we will be recording for possible broadcast. I will now pause for a few moments while the broadcast portion begins. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We welcome our audience here and on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, John Marks, founded Search for Common Ground in 1982 and is currently its president. The nonprofit organization focuses on international conflict prevention. Headquartered in Washington and Brussels, they now have offices in 18 countries. John Marks also founded and heads Common Ground Productions, which produces TV and radio programming around the world to help prevent and transform conflict. In 2006, he was awarded a Skoll Fellowship for Social Entrepreneurship. Mr. Marks is a best-selling author and a former officer with the U.S. State Department. Some of you will recall two of his prominent books from the 1970s, The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, and also The Search for the Manchurian Candidate. Let's welcome John Marks to tell us about preventing conflict.
Thank you. I'm just thrilled to be here. There are people in this audience, I mean, somebody who I went to high school with, so I mean, that's a 50-year connection. There are people I've known for 40 years, and there are people I don't know, so I'm grateful to everybody for coming, and I will hope I can give some shape and some form to that very kind introduction that you made. As was just pointed out, I'm the founder of Search for Common Ground, which is an organization that works around the world in conflict prevention and conflict resolution. I think we're the largest nonprofit organization in the field in the world. I don't know anybody who's larger doing this kind of work. The Catholic Church may claim it is, but I don't think they have other priorities, let's just say. Our mission is to find non-adversarial ways to deal with conflict. We try to shift the world. We're a transformational organization, and the way we do it is by one conflict at a time and working inside conflicts. We try to take what I call a multi-pronged approach. In other words, if you do multiple things inside a society, it's more likely that one or more are going to have an impact. And if you just do the lone training or workshop or single process, it usually doesn't last that long and doesn't have that much of an impact. So as Norma pointed out, I I'm also head of Common Ground Productions. The reason I'm head of Common Ground Productions is I founded it. And I felt that I wanted to change the world. That was a very important thing for me. And I realized that you couldn't do it 25 people at a time or 50 people at a time. You really need to do it in the millions at a time. And so back when I started Search, and we had about, oh, probably two or three employees, I went to a printer, and I had cards made up which said I was president of Common Ground Productions. Now, people who are printers who make cards don't ask you for proof. They don't ask you for credentials or whatever. So I had cards that said I was head of Common Ground Productions. I made a declaration, in fact, that I was head of Common Ground Productions. Within about 2 years of having those cards printed up, we had our first series on public television in the United States. So we were able to give some reality to it. You can also have cards printed up with no reality. When we created the reality once the cards were made. And that was an important breakthrough for us. And what I'm going to do this evening is talk to you, but I'm also going to illustrate it with video and TV, which was either made by us or made about us. And I find there's a much greater tolerance for what I have to say when I interrupt it every 5 or so minutes with, let's just say, audiovisual aids and the like. People actually remember it sometimes, or there's some image gets remembered. And that's part of what we try to do. We try to use entertaining, well-crafted video, TV, music, radio in order to change the world. And I'm going to start by showing you a piece which shows what we've done in where we started in the Middle East. And the reason I'm going to show this first is it's perhaps not the greatest television that's ever been done, but what it will illustrate is the kind of methodology, the way we work. We try to bring people together so they can see new possibilities and find common ground. And instead of having them face each other as the enemy or as people that are in the opposition, what you want them to be is to stand together and to take on a shared problem. And that's our key methodology. You can get a PhD in that particular methodology, but I've just told it to you here right now easily. Instead of having people face each other as the problem or as the enemy, you want them standing together taking on a shared problem. Now, the world would be a very big different place. It would be a transformation if we could get countries to do that. Imagine the United States and Iran standing together and trying to figure out how to solve their problems together. It's doable. But unfortunately, an adversarial way of looking at the world tends to obtain. It tends to be the way, whether in Washington or in the Middle East or in Africa, people tend to work that way, not in their own families. I mean, most of us have discovered, I have a divorce in my history, most of us discovered if we're adversarial in our personal relationships, we get divorced. Or, you know, our marriages fall apart, our children don't talk to us, and the like. It doesn't really work to make non-negotiable demands to your children. I mean, you can get away with it in the short run, but don't try it on a prolonged basis, or to your spouse, or to the people you care about and love. On a personal level, this is common sense. But we're not able, as a species yet, to apply it in a broad sense to whole countries and whole nations. Now, there's some real exceptions. South Africa in the early 90s went through a process where they did this, where Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk said that it was time for the races to live together down there, and there was a whole shift. Now, the shift did not come because of what I'm talking about. The shift came for whatever reason, tactical reasons or whatever. But once the shift was in place, once the South Africans decided they were going to do it, they used the methodology of conflict transformation, conflict resolution, to prevent violence or to limit violence. And I'm very into this because it's the best example I know of a place that was supposed to have ended in Holocaust. I mean, if you go back 20 years, everyone would tell you the only way South Africa will ever be solved is by Holocaust, by people, a violent crime. And in fact, they had the most beautiful, wonderful, peaceful transition toward a win-win country. They call it a rainbow country they've ever known. And I met my wife in the process. So it's one of those epic kinds of things. My wife is a South African. She worked in that process. And she wrote a brilliant book on it called Watching the Wind, which I commend to all of you. But what it means to me is it's possible. I'm not just a guy standing up here giving you a vision and saying, you know, this is what the world needs to work for. All of us can agree this is what the world needs to go toward. But it's happened. It happened in South Africa. To a large extent, it's happened in Northern Ireland. Though Northern Ireland, they still don't like each other very much. They still are very kind of opposing, but they're not killing each other anymore. And that's a progress. And, you know, maybe the next generation will actually get it to the next level. Or, you know, these things happen over time. Peace is a process. It is not an event. And most of us, including myself, who works in this field every day, really want it to be an event. I want peace yesterday. I want it now. Why can't we have it? Why don't we do it? Let's end war tomorrow. Well, lovely sentiments, but it just takes some time. So anyway, I'm going to start by showing you what one of our processes would look like. And this is an old thing. This is about 15 years ago, but it really does illustrate pretty well what I'm talking about. So assuming I can make the technology work, let's go. And perhaps could you hit the lights? Or can anybody hit the
lights? Search for Common Ground specializes in finding creative ways to resolve conflict. In 1991, even before Israel and its neighbors started peace talks at Madrid, Search for Common Ground launched a project called the Initiative for Peace and Cooperation in the Middle East.
The initiative is action-oriented. It's not an academic body that whose activities ends with the sessions of meetings.
Well, the initiative has started something really very creative, which is to start a dialogue between peoples of the region and between really peoples who have never had a dialogue before.
Here, for the first time, I experience a kind of atmosphere, a kind of spirit in a conference, in a gathering, which permits people to open themselves up without reservation and speak out of their heart.
First, the uniqueness of the initiative, and that is trying to find the common ground, though there are a lot of problems and differences and controversies.
Jean Lebrun is a very distinguished and well-known right-wing Israeli military man who had very fixed views about dealings with the Arabs and the Palestinians because of the initiative, and his interaction with people who he initially even refused to shake hands with have changed his attitudes, to some extent his views. I worked with him on a paper on security concerns or security regime in South Lebanon. When I first read the paper he wrote and he read the paper I wrote, we thought it would probably take us 3 years. And it took us 2 days, because this process develops a certain logic which is inherent to it and which will make things happen.
And it's also a paper which one day will emerge as predating history or the effects on the ground.
I have very great fondness for Jean Lebrun. I think he's an honest man. I think he's an honorable man. I think he's a person who has the interests of his people at heart. I think he's very wrong on almost everything he says. He probably disagrees with me. But the fact that we can sit and talk with each other and agree on certain things is outstanding. It's stupendous. It's what can I say? It's phenomenal.
So that kind, to create a climate or an atmosphere where people can do that, where he said it took them 2 days to actually work out the future of Lebanon. Now, we had been working with them for 2 years before they did that 2 days. it's a bit of an exaggeration to think it only took 2 days. But once the environment was in place, once the context was in place, they started to look for underlying interests. They started to look to see where the common ground was, and they came up with how to do it. Now, that's an old piece of tape. And in the next room, while that was going on, we were having talks between, this is about 15 years ago, between Israeli generals and Jordanian generals, all retired. And they worked out what became the basis for the security agreement between Israel and Jordan. And it would go from the meetings to the desk of the Prime Minister of Israel and the King of Jordan within 24 hours. It was a very hot process. The problem is I don't have any tape of it. So I can't show it to you, but the same process was being used there. But it's illustrative. You win some and you lose some in this field. I mean, we didn't make a breakthrough between Israel and Lebanon, but we did make a breakthrough between Israel and Jordan. I'll take 50% any time, you know? That isn't bad. And we do this work in order to have this kind of impact, not knowing which of the processes are actually going to be effective. You can't be sure it's going to work. In fact, it's very unlikely much of it's going to work. But yet you take your best guess and you move it forward in the way that, you know, based on the knowledge, based on the research, based on what looks like the best kind of way, and you get those people together, you create the environment and the like. But what we found was we were doing these kinds of processes, and it's like you have to have almost perfect timing. You want to be about 6 to 9 months in front of the official conversation if you're doing this. In other words, if you're too far in front, then you're a hopeless visionary. And if they've caught up to you, in other words, if the official, the diplomats are doing what you're doing, then there's no point in you doing it because they're doing it. And so what you want to be is just in the right place. And finding that right place, some of it's luck and some of it's skill and some of it's knowledge and everything like that. But we realized that we can't do it all the time. And we still have projects like those going on between the U.S. and Iran, between the U.S. and Syria and some other places. But we've expanded now, and we've let's just say that was early search for common ground methodology. Now, the heart of that, to create an environment in which people can come together, is still obtains. But what we've done in recent years is tried to do things across whole societies. We call it societal conflict transformation or societal conflict resolution. And in the Middle East, what we did, and I, this is, you know, I'm now heading an organization of 400 people as opposed to 2 people, so I don't do too many things hands-on, but this is a project I did myself, so I take a certain amount of pleasure out of it. About 6 or 7 years ago, we did a series of documentary films on how the Middle East, how the Palestinian-Israeli dispute could be settled. And we went through the various things. There were 4 films, and it was a series. And it was made to be on both Israeli television and Palestinian television. And actually, it was the first films in history that ever ran simultaneously on both Israeli and Palestinian TV. And then we got Abu Dhabi TV thrown in to make it kind of interesting from the Arab satellite world. And then Arabia broadcast them too. And the idea was to show it is possible to make peace, that it's not impossible. And having that possibility exist in the culture, to my mind, makes it much more likely it can actually happen. If that possibility doesn't exist, and right now it's pretty far away, but what we were trying to do was to have people see, yes, it can be done. It's not impossible. And these films were based on doing that. Well, when we did the films, and I say I wrote and produced them, so I'm going to take some flack or some credit for them. When you do documentaries, as Steve Mosby, who's a very good filmmaker in the back, will tell you, is you need to have music. Music's very important in documentary filmmaking. And I wanted music that was a fusion of Arab or Palestinian and Israeli music, because I didn't want one to say it's theirs, it's not ours, or whatever. So we got David Broza, who's kind of the Sting of Israel, to do the Israeli side, and a group called Sabrine, which is a very popular Palestinian group, and together they wrote the music. And they performed the music. And after about a year of them doing this, performing it, we convinced them that they should make a music video. And the music video actually has had more legs than the documentary. In other words, the music video lives where, it's our most popular thing on our YouTube channel. It's really something that's really nice. And it says everything that the documentary says too, but it says it in a form that people get and they remember and they like it and everything else. So you'll see a little bit of the documentary in the music video, but what I'm going to show you now is the music video. And if anybody wants to dance, that's your privilege. Let me just... okay, this is working. So you get the idea of what we were trying to do there, and bringing people together. And music like that has a much deeper impact on people than erudite words or good things. And this was what we're trying to do, is to get into the consciousness of folks. So every time we do a television series, we now do a music video, and we try to make the theme. And it becomes an advertisement for it. Every time it's played on the radio or television, the words are the words that we're trying to go. But there's a question. I'll anticipate the question, because I know we have at least one filmmaker in the audience. Why were they separately on the screen? Why weren't they in the same frame? And the answer is because it's the Middle East. They actually were in the studio, the same studio, the same night doing that. But one of the guys, the Palestinian, said he would only make the music video if we didn't show him together with the Israeli, who actually he wrote the music with and was in the same studio in Jerusalem performing. And he didn't want to be accused of collaboration, and by not being in the same frame, he could make the argument that he wasn't collaborating. So we did it. Usually you do the other opposite illusion. This one was they weren't together. Normally you want to show them together. But it's extraordinary what you can do in the edit room, let's just say. Common ground through the edit room is the way we did do that one. So next I'm going to take you to Africa, to the country of Burundi. Burundi is a place where we've been working for the last 15 years. You remember after there was, it's right next door to Rwanda, which was a country of genocide. You probably have seen, many of you, Hotel Rwanda and are familiar. You know, about 1 million people died. And the reason, one of the great contributing factors to that genocide in Rwanda was the use of media. There was something called Radio de Mille Collines, Radio of 1,000 Hills. And it was controlled by one ethnic group, and they were calling the other ethnic group cockroaches who needed to be stamped out. And it was called hate radio. And after the genocide in 1994, almost immediately after it, we went into Burundi, which was right next door to Rwanda, had essentially the same ethnic mix of Hutus and Tutsis, the same problems of land, of economy, of colonialism. It had been a Belgian colony. And in Burundi at that time, many thousands of people were dying every week in war. It wasn't genocide yet, but they really were on the verge. And what we were trying to do was to prevent the country from going over the edge, preventing genocide, which I could really get behind. I mean, it seems to me it's a noble pursuit. And we did a lot of things. It happened to be one of those moments which was very important that I'm not quite sure in the history of our organization, because most of the NGOs, non-governmental organizations like us, were in the process of pulling out. And even the USAID mission pulled out. And as a consequence, we started to get adequate funding for the work we wanted to do. And we were able to put together a multi-pronged approach. And at the heart of it was a radio station. And it was to counter hate radio. But the opposite of hate radio is not love radio. The opposite of hate radio, I think, is common ground radio. It's bringing people together. And we had Hutu journalists and Tutsi journalists who worked for us. We were the international mediating third party. And we had people from both ethnic groups who worked for us. And they were all our employees were considered traitors to their ethnic group. And we had one guy get killed, and we never were quite clear. One of our reporters, we were never clear if he was killed because he worked for us or he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But we knew there was a lot of threatening going on. And these were people who risked their lives to bring the country back together. And as part of this, we did about 15 hours a week of radio broadcasts, radio programming, which we gave to all the stations in the country, the national radio and the church radio and everything else. We were not a radio station. We were a radio studio, which was producing and giving it away to anyone who would run it. And we did a lot of work with women's groups. Women were very much, how would I put this? they weren't killing each other. I've never found a place where women will kill each other for reasons of face. Men will do that, I mean, unfortunately, in the world. And so we work with thousands of women's groups across the country. The women were bearing the brunt of the conflict in Burundi and in most places, but particularly in Burundi at the time. And we were trying to empower women as peacemakers. And what I'm going to show you is about 4 minutes from a PBS documentary, and it features my wife, Susan Collin Marks, who some of you know, who was in this in the middle. So let's do that, and you'll get a sense. We were holding meetings around the country for reconciliation. We would bring together people who had had these experiences, these horrible experiences, and we were trying to get them, if not to forgive, to start living together and the like. And this is a scene from one of those reconciliation meetings. So I just need to get the right thing up here, and I'll be off.
Nanje cyarangiye bariko barandondera naragiye gutabaza umugabo umwe mu rundi rugo arambira ati jewe sindabishoboye cangenda mu rundi rugo ndahasanga umukenyezi umugabo wiwe yari nka harya hirya umugabo yarafise ibigwanisha ndabwiranya umukenyezi nti nyegeza umukenyezi ati jesi no bishobora nge mbaze umugabo wanje umugabo inzu yiwe yari yugaye Hamara genda arabaza umugabo. Gawo we yaciye agenda, umugore acaranye ugururi yaranyugarana. Anyugaranye mu nyuma baraza kundondera. Baramenya hondi. Uwo mugore arankapugurura. Batugurura turafise turiko turarondera umuntu. Ari bahejeje kuntema. Uwo mugore yari yabonye ko ntacikaye. Aca afata uduhunda nari ruhande y'irugaramo. Aca afata uduhunda abanza kumpa impuzu yiwe. Arafuka iyo mpuzu natoye ubwenge ndayifise barambura barangaburira barafashije mu nyuma hahava haraza abajejwe umutekano barabwira ati ntiyapfuye mugabo reka tumujane kwa muganga urumva rero uwo mukenyezi nagira ndabashikire ko yuko abakenyezi bagiraho bahanura abagabo babo hanyuma amaze kuja
The pain of being in a violent conflict is so great that it shuts people down from their own humanity, let alone anybody else's. The telling of the story connects us each with what happened. It brings it out and it allows for healing to take place. This was one of the very strong features of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Uje nararekuriye abantu kandi ni byiza kurekuriranira niho tworonka amahoro tudatanguye kurengera ibintu byose byadushikiye nta nuwe atabuze muri mwebwe nta nuwe atagize ingorane n'ahandi hoho kandi tuzoronka tutayabonkeje ngo bayakurane murakoze
So what we're trying to do is to change the story. It's that In Burundi, traditionally, or at least when this was all going on, or before it was going on, to somebody, you supported your ethnic group no matter what they were doing. If they were killing, there was ethnic solidarity. And that was called, we called negative solidarity. And we wanted to encourage positive solidarity. So that was called a Positive Solidarity Day. And the idea was that to save the life of another human being of a different ethnic group was an act of heroism. It wasn't an act of, you know, of being a traitor to your own group. And that was the lesson we were trying to get across. But we had lots of those meetings. We also did a radio series, which was called Portraits, Pillars of Humanity. And it was about Hutus who had saved the lives of Tutsis and Tutsis who had saved the lives of Hutus. And we thought it would only go on for, you know, a limited amount of time. They went on for 5 years. It was a weekly show, and there were call-ins. And the call-ins would evoke more and more. People would say, well, this is what happened to me. And we saw it as a way of doing a national catharsis. And I think in the end, we were able to change the definition of what a hero was in Burundi. A hero was not somebody who was in solidarity with his own ethnic group when his own ethnic group was doing something atrocious. A hero was somebody who saved the life of somebody from another ethnic group. And I'm not sure it was universally achieved, but we got that message across. And you did it by repetition. You did it by soap opera. You did it by those kinds of meetings. Media goes very far. It doesn't go very deep. The fact that you had those meetings at the core of it made the radio and we didn't do television in Burundi. The radio go very, very far. And that was the whole strategy. Now, we took advantage of popular culture in Burundi. And for those of you who know Burundi, I'm not sure there's anybody in this room who does, drumming is huge, drums. And so we had national drumming competitions. And where they, you know, where tens of thousands of people would come to the national stadium and see Drummers for Peace. And people competed, again, cross-ethnic groups for peace and the like. And one of the culture heroes, well, Burundi is a place with a great Rastafarian interest. I'm not quite sure why this is so, but Rastas do very well in Burundi. And Ziggy Marley, who's the son of Bob Marley, is a great culture hero in Burundi. So, you know, we do these kinds of things. So we had Ziggy do some PSAs for us, public service announcements, in which he spoke out for peace. And he did it in English and what could only be called phonetic Kurundi. I hear his pronunciation was not too good. But in any case, we did these things, and Burundi's an unbelievably mistrustful place. And these were radio PSAs initially. And people were saying, how do we really know it's Ziggy Marley? Maybe it's a Ziggy Marley impersonator or something. So we went back to Ziggy, and we told him about the problem, and we asked him to do television PSAs so they could see it was he. Well, it's a country that may have 200 television sets. There are not a lot of television sets in Burundi, but the word got out. So I'm going to show you a Ziggy Marley televised PSA, which people finally believe we really were dealing with the real Ziggy. So, excuse me.
Greetings, I am Ziggy Marley, African musician. I love peace, I love Burundi and Africa. I love life. I like to thank you all who save lives. You honored humanity. You are pillars of peace. May your deeds inspire the rest of the world. One love.
We did about five of those. It didn't take too long to film them. Anyway, let's see where we're going next. Okay. From here, I'm going to take you to West Africa, to Sierra Leone, where there was a huge problem of child soldiers. Many of you may have seen the film Blood Diamond, which gets into this a bit. Blood Diamonds, I guess it's called. And it was a huge, huge problem. And we decided we needed to work with these kids. Now, actually, here was the catalytic event was in Liberia one day where we had a radio studio like Burundi. About half a dozen kids who were former child soldiers came marching into our studio and had some demands. And let's just say our staff had an initial bit of fright when this happened. And what the kids wanted, they said, we're doing a lot of broadcasting for adults, but we're not doing anything for kids. And would we be interested in having them do some shows for us? And the answer was, of course, yes. And I wish, you know, and when I heard about it, I'd say, I wish I had thought of that one. There was something called Children's Express in the United States, so the idea resonated with me. And we decided we would do something, and we set up Golden Kids Radio Network, which was produced by kids, mainly former child soldiers, for kids. And it turned out it was hugely popular with adults, too. And it's spread now from Liberia to Sierra Leone, and they do it in Cote d'Ivoire. And it's one of our more popular programs. So I'm going to show you a little segment about a young man who works for us named Stephen Swanky. And you'll get the idea.
You'd never guess by looking at him that Stephen Swanky was once a hardcore soldier. Now he seems like any other 17-year-old boy. But like Abu and Fatmata, Swanky has a past that haunts him.
In 1997, the rebel came and attacked. He said, stop there, if you run, we'll shoot at you. So we went to the bush. When I was with the rebels, I was always sad because the situation is so bad.
For 4 years, he carried a gun instead of a school bag. He was 12 when rebels stole him away, 16 when the UN mandated his release. He was reunited with his family, but after a short time, he made the tough decision to leave home again and return to school.
Divide whatever space you have in your book into two parts. What I teach, we have what and what?
I miss my education. When I was with the rebels, the thing that I didn't attend school.
With every step he took forward, Swanky's life changed for the better. He is now a reporter for the popular African radio show, Talking Drums.
Is this Mr. Swanky?
Hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine.
Talking Drums.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah,
I heard about it. Congratulations. Yeah. A very hot show.
Thank you.
Can I sit here with you?
He interviews everyone from former child soldiers to government officials.
I'm Stephen Swanky. I'm from Freetown. Presently, I'm at...
Today, he's sharing his talent with me.
Mr. Michael, you're welcome to meet me.
Thank you, Stephen Swanky. It's a pleasure to be here on Talking Drums. And
when I was with Talking Drum Studio, I usually interview my friends who have been with the rebels. Sometimes explain their stories to me.
Was there one interview in particular that you gave, that you've got, that you felt was very important for your listeners?
Actually, I interviewed some of my colleagues to explain their stories so the people in the community, they will be able to accept them back. So these are one of the most things our program is doing. When the rebels...
With courage and conviction, Swanky has put his past behind him. He hopes his work in radio will help families accept ex-combatants like Abu.
Okay, so I'm now going to take you to what is our biggest current project. And it's we've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years, most of our television has been drama, soap opera for social change. And the idea is by using fiction, a fictional format, you can really reach people in a way that you can't with documentary. With all due respect, documentary has a limited audience, and it's too bad. And I love to do it, and intellectually it's wonderful, but it has a limited audience. But think of The Cosby Show or All in the Family and the kind of impact they had on America. And you get that occasionally with a documentary. An Inconvenient Truth had a profound impact. But we think that soap opera and drama on a continuing basis is the way to go. And we're doing a series now in 15 different countries, which is called The Team. And the idea of The Team, except where it's called L'Équipe in French-speaking countries, but the idea of The Team is that you have a soccer team, a football team, as the world would say. And on that team, there are kids from the whole gamut of the population. They reflect the diversity of the country. So if there's ethnic conflict or tribal conflict or religious conflict or economic conflict or social conflict, they're on our team. And remember, there are 11 people on a team, so we can put a lot of conflicting parties on a particular team. And the core metaphor is very simple. If they don't cooperate, they don't score goals. And within that context, you can deal with every social issue in the country. A star striker may become HIV positive and deny it and then become a responsible spokesperson, Magic Johnson. Or a corrupt minister steals the money for the practice pitch and then an investigative press finds it out. You can do any social issue within this context. And one advantage of doing drama or soap opera is you're writing the script, except it's not me writing the script. It's people who live in the country where we're doing this. We don't try to write these scripts from 10,000 miles away. We have local writers who work within a common ground framework, what I would call a common ground framework, and we provide that framework, and we provide the organizing and usually the funding, and then they provide the script. So it's culturally resonates with wherever they are. And that's very, very important. So we're doing it in 15 countries, which means there are 15 different productions with 15 different sets of writers and the like. And it's been a very successful formula. It's the most successful thing we've ever done. And our phone has started to ring. About 2 weeks ago, we got a call from the European Union. Would we move it into Yemen? No. We had never thought of Yemen before, but it seemed like an interesting idea, and we're exploring it and sending a mission to it. Of course, they wanted to fund it, and funding for this thing is kind of important. Our big funder is the British government for this. And, you know, the Brits are kind of football mad or soccer mad. They love this kind of thing. So it becomes something they're very interested in, and we're using it around the world to make a difference. And about 6 weeks ago, PBS had a documentary on the Now program about the team in Kenya. I don't know if any of you saw it, but I'm going to show you about a 3.5-minute clip from that. I can just
welcome to Now. Movies and TV around the world are saturated with images of violence and horror. But is it possible to use pop culture in a different way to promote peace and understanding across a country?
Milly Mugati is a 26-year-old Kenyan who lives here in the heart of Nairobi. She lives on her own. Her parents died when she was just a teenager, and she was raised by her brother. Life has been a real struggle for Milly, with a lot of uncertainty. But she's got something to look forward to.
It was so emotional. You should have seen the
film. Milly is now a working actress. Today, she and her friend Bonaventure are rehearsing some lines together.
And if we win this game, I know he's not going to be so harsh on me.
It's for a new soap opera series that's taking on one of the most serious issues for Kenyans today, the hatred and violence that arise from tribal divisions. The soap opera is called The Team. It's a show about a co-ed team of young soccer players in Nairobi. They're all from different tribes, and in Kenya, tribe is a very big deal. John Marks is the visionary behind the soap opera, The Team. Call it soap opera for social change. But how exactly can a soap opera keep people from killing each other?
I'm not naive. You don't watch one of our television shows and drop your submachine gun. But you can change the environment so it becomes more and more difficult to be in violent conflict.
In 1982, Marx founded Search for Common Ground. Its mission is to bring tools for peace building into conflict zones. Marx and his group took the world's most popular sport and combined it with one of the world's most popular entertainment formats on radio and TV. The team is now in 12 countries, each with its own national version.
The whole script is really good, but this one last sequence is great.
Deborah Jones, a screenwriter from Hollywood, was brought in to help with dramatic structure. But the Kenyan writers are in charge of the storylines and the character details.
The moment you say stupid, you've killed the opportunity for engagement.
Deborah works closely with Mburugu Gikunda, the executive producer in Kenya. Gikunda chose not to assign specific tribes to the characters or even give them telltale last names. Gikunda, who has worked for years as a media producer in Kenya, agrees that in some cases, the media itself was to blame for provoking those tribal feuds that broke out after the 2007 election. Gikunda is committed, now more than ever, to using media in positive ways. It's why he's working with Search for Common Ground.
We're changing the political vocabulary, and that's an incredibly important thing in areas where conflict, because to have conflict, to have violence, you need to be able to dehumanize the other side. And if you can rehumanize them, if you can give them real life and you get into their problems and you see their problems the same as your problems, then you're talking about changing things.
In today's turbulent democracy, there are politicians who use tribal divisions to inflame passions and get votes.
Why, Grandma? Because it's the truth. If we all focus on being different tribes, what makes us Kenyans?
The team pushes back, asking Kenyans of all tribes to think of themselves as Kenyans first.
Okay, so that's the team. We're on the air in Cote d'Ivoire. We just had a premiere last week in Morocco. There's a radio series going on in Ethiopia and another one going on in Nepal. And we're in production in DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and a couple other places. I'm going to lose it probably, trying to remember all this stuff. And we're doing it all with three full-time employees. But lots of people on the ground doing the work. I mean, I'm not saying that three people are making all that stuff, but we're doing it lightly, let's say. We don't want to build up a big infrastructure. We want to empower people in the countries where we're working and the like. And we have a capacity issue. We're just hiring a new. I'm going to put this out here. I'm really looking for somebody with dramatic, episodic, soap opera experience who would like to do this kind of work and is probably a return Peace Corps volunteer or somebody with the thing. Doing this kind of work in a place like Congo is very different than doing it in Hollywood. Let me just say the culture is not the same. And you need a person who can do both. So anyway, if anybody knows that person, send me the CV or come up to me afterwards. So you get a sense of the kind of thing we do on this. And I'm going to end. The last thing I'm going to show you is another music video, which was made for us by Melissa Etheridge and Salman Ahmed. Salman Ahmed is a leader of a Pakistani group called Janoon, which is arguably the most popular rock group in the subcontinent. And they met at the Nobel Prize ceremonies a couple of years ago. There's a concert, and Salman sang for Muhammad Yunus from Bangladesh, and Melissa was there for Al Gore, for whom she did the music for An Inconvenient Truth. And they wrote this song together. They became friends. And once the song was written, they wanted to dedicate it to somebody and do it for the benefit of somebody. So this is called Ring the Bells. We did this with Participant Productions, who are my heroes. That's Jeff Skull's production company in Hollywood, which has made such things as An Inconvenient Truth and, what else have they done? Syriana and Good Night and Good Luck. They do socially conscious filmmaking, and they contributed most of the money and the effort to this, and it's now featured on their new social website. So it's called Ring the Bells, and this is the end of it, and I'll take some questions after this if people want to ask any. So.
I believe in peace, my only wish. I believe that we can coexist. Let's go further now than we've ever gone before. And ring the bells, ring the bells of change, ring the bells, every boy and every girl, ring the bells, ring the bells of peace all over the world. To feel our power, to create the dream, to step out from the dark, past our father's feet. As we believe it shall be done. Here we stand as soldiers now, turning our swords into plows. There is not a nobler climb, achieving peace in our own time. I know peace begins with me, with all
that's all I wanted to say and to show you, and I'd be really glad to take questions, and if anybody has any, or hi, Karen. Should I give you this microphone, maybe?
Hollywood is the third largest film producer in the world, a Nigerian group. There are several directors or producers that do a show a week, a soap opera type thing. Have you been in contact with them at all?
I don't know them specifically. We did a 49-part series in Nigeria, which was called The Station, and it was about a fictional TV station, news station in Lagos, kind of think CNN International. And, of course, all the reporters were from different tribes. And this week they would go out and cover education, and next week they would look at ethnic violence. And we did that for four seasons, and it was one of the biggest projects we've ever did. And we took it then to Egypt, where Egyptian screenwriters rewrote the scripts and put them into Arabic and really Egyptianized them. And we didn't tell anybody in Cairo that's what we were doing. I mean, on the air and stuff like that. I'm not sure of the cultural ramifications, but it seemed to work very well, and it was highly ranked in Egypt. And it was just one of those areas where we did do it. And doing this kind of stuff in Nigeria was a great idea, I think.
I'm just wondering, do the productions survive? Do they continue to carry on after you leave the country? Are you building an industry there for
right.
these people?
Well, we have a very big library at this point. But what's happening, and this was not foreseen, is that more and more broadcasters are taking these things. So the Kenyan thing that you saw has been bought by MNET, which is a South African satellite network which broadcasts every hotel room in Africa. It's been bought by CFI, Canal Français International, which is the French satellite network. And Link TV in San Francisco is going to start it for their World Cup thing. I don't know if you know Link TV, but it's local, and they have 30 million potential viewers. And so what we're finding is that there's something of a market. We're not doing it because there's a market. In other words, you don't make shows in Kenya using part Swahili and part English, which that was why you were getting subtitles. Some of it was in Swahili. That's not real saleable in the international television market. But we're finding there is a kind of a limited market for it, and all the stations we're dealing with have been rerunning the shows and the like. So we think it goes on and on and on. We also do a lot of outreach with it and integration. In other words, you saw there was a meeting I was attending where that was because in eight places of very high conflict in Kenya, places where there was violence and a lot of killing during the big violent troubles after the elections, we did showings for community leaders who represented different tribes and civil society organizations. And they came together six times to see all 13 series. We did two half-hour episodes each time. And then there would be a facilitated conversation with facilitators who we had trained in how to evoke what had been going on. And they seemed to be very cathartic. And so we were trying to reach out beyond what we're doing. In Pakistan, where we're just going in, we're doing educational stuff. We're doing curriculum based on the TV. And there's curricular material and the like based on it. And the idea is to take it as far as possible. We want to create in these places a campaign that, for example, in Kenya, for one Kenya, for a Kenya that's beyond tribalism. And you get a really good base from the TV and radio because we have 3.5 million viewers and listeners every week, which is substantial in the country. It's about 10% of the country, a little less than 10% of the country. So we're reaching a lot of people, and we want to use it to go further. And as I said, the TV stuff and the radio is important, but you need more stuff beyond that. So we're organizing a soccer tournament, a football tournament in Kenya. And you may have noticed there were girls in the scene. And one of the thing which our Kenyan scriptwriters came up with is it's a mixed boys and girls team. It's called Seven on a Side. And you have to have at least three girls and four boys playing together, and which was revolutionary in Kenya, too. I mean, they invented a pretext and everything else. I wouldn't have dared try that one. But, you know, our screenwriters did it. And so the national tournament will be for Seven on a Side, where everybody has to come from a different tribe and there need to be at least three girls on every team. And that's never been done before, too. They've had lots of soccer tournaments, but never that kind of soccer tournament. And our television station, our network, which is the leading network in the country, will televise the finals. And we're going to try to make it into a national event and bring attention to what we're doing. You know, the real team, if you will. So it becomes something to build from and to integrate with all the rest of our programs. And it's a platform for doing these other kinds of programs.
How does it work with the team? Is this a showing once a week, and is it a developing story, or is it little short episodes?
Yeah, it is once a week, usually. Though in Pakistan, we're going to do four a week, because that's the way they do evening soap opera, and repetition being important. So but in every other country, it is one a week. Sometimes a half hour, sometimes an hour, depending on what people have an appetite for. And the like. And usually, it's funny, in Nigeria with the short series where we're talking about, we were using multi-stream stuff where you would have two or three stories going at the same time. And viewers found that confusing. So what we're moving toward is single story, each episode standing alone, but the characters being consistent. And the characters take on, if you will, a familiarity that with people in the country. We have a radio soap opera in Liberia, and there's a character named Stephen, and Stephen is corrupt. And in Liberia now, if you want to say somebody is corrupt, you call them a Stephen. And that's kind of what we're trying to do. We're trying to draw attention to these sort of things, and it becomes a way of getting people to focus on things. You're really starting to create the archetypes in the society. And the corrupt guy doesn't win. I mean, we're making the soap operas, you know. I mean, that's the one thing. One beauty of doing soap operas, they're written by my colleagues. They're not written by people who think corrupt people should be come out ahead and the like.
Yeah, this is really so exciting what you're doing with the media and peace media, developing peace media and applying it like that, and the conflict transformation work as well. Can you do that in this country? We need it.
Can we do it?
In this country.
Would like to. This country certainly can use it. You know, a show like All in the Family had that kind of impact, you know, where Archie Bunker made it not cool. It was after that show was on, it was not cool to be a bigot, you know. And I think it had more effect on ending bigotry in this country than probably any other single thing. There were lots of other things happening. But if you want to take one thing that was on television, All in the Family had a profound impact here. And we'd like to do it. The problem is, and now I get crazy, I know how to raise money to do this stuff in Africa. There's no money available that I've been able to find to do it here. Because of the structure of the television industry, because of the way Hollywood operates, we get most of our money from foreign aid agencies. The Brits are big funders. The Americans fund us. They don't fund in the United States. You know, it can't be foreign aid. And I am looking, in fact, I think it may happen in Europe first. I'd like to do the team in Europe. It seems to me, let's just take a place like France or the Netherlands. They have profound problems with people of different ethnicities, different religions. There's a Muslim Christian thing. There's a North African thing. And you could do this team set in the suburbs of Paris. You could do it in the Netherlands. But we're looking for the right producer because we don't know how to produce there. And the budgets are so much higher. I would be embarrassed to tell you how little we pay for some of this. We have done it for as long. I'm going to tell you because I'm going to be embarrassed, and I have filmmakers in the audience. We have done it for as little as $6,000 a half an hour and as much as $100,000 a half an hour. And still, the sitcom you see on television from Hollywood probably is a $2 to $3 million budget per half hour. And you have to do what the local market will support and what our funding will support. But we've learned how to do it, and we've learned how to get good prices and the like. But I would love to do it in the United States, let me just tell you. I even have some treatments out.
Thank you. I'm seeing increasing interest in things like YouTube and social networks and mobile video in places like the Middle East. Do you think these new platforms can be effective mediums for peace media?
Kenya is our most advanced new media place. We have a webmaster who does this stuff he is exactly 23 years old, which is a little old for it, but, you know, I mean, he gets the job done. And we have a Kenyan Facebook group. There's a Kenyan Twitter group. He d- does it every day. I mean, he's on. You have. It's labor intensive. I mean, you just don't do this stuff and put the stuff out. And there's a website there that has videos. We have a YouTube channel and all that. But we're not in. Unfortunately, in a place like Kenya, there's a limited market. I think we have 20,000 people in our YouTube group, which is fabulous for Kenya, but doesn't really scratch the surface. And unfortunately, there's not the broadband or the computer capacity to really get into this stuff. Cell phones are where it's at, because cell phones are the medium that really communicates. And I know that people put clips on cell phones and stuff like that, but it doesn't, you know, it costs you money to watch it. And that's a problem in a country that's so poor. So we're looking for applications and killer apps, but ones that work in such a place, not stuff that works in, you know, Palo Alto. And unfortunately, the technology doesn't support the vision of most people who are into it. And so you need to be appropriate in your technology. And I'm open that no good idea will be refused.
It's easy to see the how this could build.
I think your microphone's not on. Is it? Okay.
Hello. Yeah.
Good.
Okay. It's easy to see, and you've been talking about how this could create a groundswell and a national movement where people can recognize the characters. And but I was wondering, because you get money from foreign aid also, if they ask you to measure impact on these media vehicles, or whether. I know they like to do things like that, or whether you just use it as a platform and then measure impact on your conflict outreach activities.
It's a very appropriate question. I'm surprised it took so long to be asked. Usually that's question number two. We do a lot of before and after surveys. Our funders demand that we show there is an impact. So we do a before and after show. So, and I'll tell you like a result. In Macedonia, we did a children's series that went on for 5 years. It was about kids from different ethnic groups who play together and work together kind of against adults. So we did it with Sesame Workshop, who does Sesame Street. They were our partner in doing it. And before watching it, only 30% of the kids in Macedonia would invite home a kid from a different ethnic group after school to play. That was the indicator. That's a pretty personal thing. Come to my house after school and play with me. You know, not everybody wants to do that. After watching only 8 episodes, and we did over 40, it went from 30% to 60%. And that's a substantial behavior change. And we can document that in other places too. But that kind of statistic, we have a lot of those sorts of statistics. And then we use anecdotal stuff. We were doing a soap opera in Palestine, in Jerusalem, and somebody I know pulls into a gas station to get his car filled up with gas, and they won't come out and give it to him because they're listening to our soap. That kind of stuff. And you use a combination, and also PBS gives us a half an hour of documentary, which is in a sense an evaluation. You need the statistical stuff, but, you know, we just showed that at USAID last week. And let me say, they got it. And you get it in a way from that sort of television that you don't always get it from a 30-page.